Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Denham. I'm the principal here at BCC Langara. My only function this afternoon is to provide some sort of transition and a period of brief pause while our two guests get settled down for the proper business of this meeting. I think, as you know, our guests this afternoon are Norman Penner, the author of Winnipeg 1919, and Bill Pritchard, who, if you haven't met him already, and from looking around, I know many of you have, is truly a part of Canadian history, and a part that for Western Canadians is one I think we too often forget. There is, I'm sure, hardly a family resident in Western Canada for the past 60 years which did not have some direct or indirect contact either with the Winnipeg strike of 1919 or with those affairs in which Mr. Pritchard played a most active part in the Pacific Coast during the 1930s. Mr. Penner will lead off, and we will then allow the meeting to take such course as our guests devise for it.
Mr. Penner, thank you. Yesterday we were on the Judy Lamarche show, and I see in the audience what I've noted ever since coming here, meeting Bill Pritchard, is that the Winnipeg General Strike extended the lifespan of many people. We had so many people between the age of 80 and 90 phoning up and remembering the strike and remembering Bill Pritchard. One fellow phoned up and said, remember me, Bill, I'm Pete. For me, the work on the book Winnipeg 1919 was a bit of a labor of love because of its personal connotations to me. Coming from Winnipeg, growing up during the 30s, coming to political consciousness during that time, and getting to know most of the people who played such a leading role in the strike. And those of you who come from Winnipeg will recall that in many ways the 30s were a replay of the Winnipeg General Strike. You had labor on one side in the city council. You had the remnants of the Civic Election Committee sitting on the other side and battling out the same issues, the same principles as they had battled out in the 1919 General Strike. I knew people like Johns, Queen. Of course, my father was a participant in the Winnipeg General Strike, although not a leading member of it, but became very prominent in the labor and socialist movement in Winnipeg. I got to know a man like McMurray and Stubbs, two outstanding lawyers who threw their lot completely on the side of the working class, defended them, and defended them ever since. I knew, of course, Reverend A.E. Smith, who was, at the time of the general strike, the chairman of the Methodist Conference, and he, like so many other Methodist ministers, threw their lot in with the strike, of whom the other two outstanding ones were Reverend William Ivins and Reverend J.S. Woodsworth. I didn't know Dixon because he had died at an early age, but I'd heard many stories of Dixon as being one of the outstanding, what they used to call, flaming tribunes of the working people of Winnipeg. And so knowing these people and having worked on this book, it naturally is a very great thrill for me to meet the one man I didn't know, but I'd heard a lot about, and that's our guest this afternoon, William Pritchard. I expected when I was working on this book over a period of a year or more that it would have a good response. But frankly, I never really expected the response that it has been getting, and it's only been out for 2.5 months. Is being widely accepted. and particularly widely accepted by the young people who have only heard about the Winnipeg General Strike from fleeting references that appear in the odd history book. And it seems to me that the reason for this acceptance is because this book, by making available for the first time since 1920, of the striker's own account of the history, and making available the famous address that William Pritchard delivered to the jury for 2 days, from 10 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night, that doing this provides the missing link in their understanding of what has been written so far about the Winnipeg General Strike. And I think we have reached a new phase now in the understanding of this epic event. And that is a stage where we can say, well, we have closed the case for the defense. Together with material that has come out over the last couple of decades, this book now makes it abundantly clear that the charges that the Winnipeg General Strike was a seditious conspiracy are false. And when Pritchard said in his address in March 1920, "Whether or not we will be vindicated in this court, we shall be vindicated in process of time by history." And I think that time has arrived. And so we have to go over to another phase, in my opinion. And that is, having satisfied ourselves on the basis of all the available evidence that there was no seditious conspiracy, we have to examine the other wider implications of the strike. We have to ask the question, how then were these men convicted? How then was the strike smashed? And a whole number of questions related to the incredible events that took place during and immediately after the strike. And I think, and I'd like to in the next short period, suggest some of the issues that require now study afresh, and particularly by the young scholars who are so interested in the Winnipeg General Strike. And I think the I'd like to quote another very pungent passage from many pungent passages in Pritchard's book. He says, "I am the accused, but I will now become the accuser." He says, "I stand de facto, the accuser of men who have lent themselves to the most damnable piece of infamy that has ever been perpetrated in any part of the British Empire in the name of law. I stand here today de facto the accuser of men who entered into a conspiracy to rob the Constitution, to carve the vitals out of the privileges of British subjects, who knocked the props from underneath free speech and free press. Everyone who lent themselves to that business, gentlemen, aided and abetted, counseled and procured, and assisted and formed the common intention to enter into a malicious conspiracy to do away with the entire British Constitution." Now, that may seem a bit strong, but the substances of it is what has to be examined, because Mr. J.S. Wordsworth, when the question was reopened in 1926, in the House of Commons, made the same charge, that far from there having been a conspiracy on the part of labor the conspiracy was on the part of the government to do away with the rights of labor. Now, one reviewer in discussing my book, and I respect this man very much, and but he objects to the use of the word conspire. He says the use of the term conspire is unfortunate, as it suggests sinister plotting. Of course, I don't quite agree with him in there that it suggests sinister plotting, because I would like to draw your attention to the fact, when you get to read the indictment that charged the strike leaders with conspiracy, they were charged with conspiring at open public meetings. They were conspiring at the Walker Theater. They were conspiring at the Western Labor Conference. They were conspiring at the Trades and Labor Council meeting. So the suggestion that it only relates to sinister plotting is not valid. But the reason he does not like this particular phrase is because he said, after all, what they did was wrong, but they did it in good faith. Now, 6,000 people out of a population of 175,000 fully in support of the demands of the strike committee. And on the other side, what were there? It was first the Citizens Committee of 1,000. Nobody ever saw a list of who was on that Citizens Committee, so we have no way of verifying whether, in fact, it was a committee of 1,000. But let's say it was a committee of 1,000, and they have three children each. So we have 3,000. But then we have the following. We have the RCMP increased from 27 to 270. The local police force of 240 is fired, and 2,000 special police are hired in their place. So we have 2,000 special police. On secret orders from Arthur Meehan in Ottawa, the militia is reactivated. 3,000 men training daily with small arms and machine guns in the Tuxedo Barracks. And, of course, the Winnipeg Press. Fulminating day after day against the strike. So in view of this, it is, of course, no surprise that defeat of the strike was inevitable. And when, after the 8 strike leaders had been arrested on June the 16th, and then the riot took place on June the 21st, in which one person was killed and 30 were injured, and then Fred Dixon was arrested because he took over the editorship of the Western Labor News. And then J.S. Woodsworth was arrested because he took over from Fred Dixon. It was quite obvious that under no circumstances would the government allow the strike to be settled. In fact, it is now known that during the course of the strike, a message was received in Ottawa to the effect that the metal trades employers were willing to discuss a settlement. And Meehan wired right back that under no circumstances must they discuss settlement, because this would be considered a victory for the workers. But the strike, as we know, while it was defeated in its immediate demands for collective bargaining, and many workers who went out on strike were blacklisted, and the atmosphere of terror that pervaded Winnipeg during the strike continued for some time afterwards, looking at it in its historical perspective, the strike was a great victory. It was a great turning point. Because when we ask ourselves, as we must, this question, I mean, after all, yes, all of these things went on, they were bad things, they were terrible things, but yet democracy survived. And it did. And the first evidence that democracy had survived was when they kicked Meehan out of Parliament in the election of 1921. His unionist government fell apart, and all his conservative followers in the West, 50 of them, including himself, were defeated. That was a judgment by the electorate. In the provincial elections in Manitoba that took place in June 1920, 11 Labour men were elected to Parliament, to the provincial Parliament, of which four were strike leaders, three of whom were still in the penitentiary when they were elected. And the next year, J.S. Woodsworth was elected in Winnipeg Centre and remained there, as you know, for the rest of his life as the representative of that riding. So this was on the positive side, but it illustrates something that is of a general historical importance, and that is that it was because, even after the defeat of the strike, the strikers didn't give up. They formed a defense committee. They put out this literature, which we are now publishing. They went across the country from one end of the country to another, explaining their case to the public. It was because the labor movement, therefore, saved democracy at that point. By not giving up. And one thing you will note when you read this these remarkable documents is the air of defiance that's in those books, the spirit of resistance, and the knowledge that the labor movement has got to play a very important role in defending democracy. You know, one of the first social